Nigel left.
Welcome to the Church of Mavis, everybody. We're here live. It's Saturday night, and we got a good guest lined up. Tonight's guest is Glenn Kreisberg, alternative history theory pioneers, editor of Lost Knowledge of the Ancients, a Graham Hancock reader. We'll get to our guest shortly. Just wanted to say a couple of things. Next Saturday and Sunday, we're doing two shows at 2 p.m. Eastern, pre-recorded, because JoJo's going out of town with Miss Montado for her birthday. Happy birthday to Linda. Happy birthday to Linda. I'll put something weird on your wall, don't worry. Next, I'll tell you who the shows are. Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern is Frank Joseph. We're going to do a show about the Norse mythology on his book about gods of the runes. So basically, we're going to have a show completely about the Norse, his book's Gods of the Runes. I had to look at the title there to remember because of my crappy memory. The title of the show will be Oh Sweet Ragnarok, and basically we're just going to talk about the Norse completely. We've never did a show about them completely, so looking forward to that. A lot of interesting things. Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, we're doing another pre-recorded show with Guy's friend Max. We're doing a two-hour show on Nikola Tesla. So, what's your friend's complete name, Guy?
He goes by Screenwriter Max Crowe. He's a screenwriter. He's got his own production company. He's a history buff. Back in the day, I've known him like 25 years. Back in the day, he was like the fifth member of our band. Dude's like MacGyver. He's an engineer. He's a metallurgist. All sorts of stuff. Right now, he's writing a screenplay on Tesla, and he got a lot of firsthand knowledge from the curator of the Tesla Museum at the hotel he stayed at for like forever. So he's got all these cool little tidbits about, you know, Tesla you don't really hear, or it's just actual, you know, shit people.
Yeah.
So before we get to the guests and everything like that, I want to make sure that I thank everyone from when I was out and, you know, injured and everything, for all the kind words and prayer circles and all that stuff you did for me. I really, really appreciate it. I mean, I didn't get to tell you last week, but it's coming along fine.
Didn't lose his leg. We didn't have to put a peg leg there.
Really, man, it was close to that.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, we put out the call for the prayers and brought in the chi, baby. That's how we roll. We even got on UFO Undercover and sent out the chi request. That's how we roll. That's how the JoJo rolls. That's how we roll, baby. That's right. But just glad you're feeling better and back. because I hate doing shows by myself. Because when I run out of crap to talk about, that's when you're there. So, just to mention our other two guests for October, our Inner Traditions Month. It'll be the last month of Inner Traditions scheduling for us. John Chambers, his book, Victor Hugo's Conversations with the Spirit World. I titled that show Quasimodo's Dream because I'm weird. So, yeah, a little hunchback. Yeah, Victor Hugo in the house. Oh, yeah. And then our October 29th show, I'm looking really forward to that. It's with the Iroquois Supernatural Talking Animals and Medicine People, Michael Bastine and Mason Winfield, and basically they're going to tell us a lot of crazy, weird, strange ghost stories from the Iroquois tribes and stuff. So that's going to be really cool. I've been reading some of them. They're pretty weird. So looking forward to that. And then November, we're going to UFO it up a lot. I think I don't think any of these people have been on the network. So that's going to be an interesting November. And then just a quick brief December, Micah Hanks and Jared Brox, my web designer, we're doing an alien show. My girlfriend, Carrie Boyer, she's going to do a show about her experiences. She is a client of Bud Hopkins. And then our final show of the year will be Andy Colvin designing his own Mothman Roundtable. So I don't know who he's going to stick on that, but we're working on that. So definitely a good lineup. So we're booked up here, and I'll start booking for January at some point. All right, anything else? I saw some weird thing going around saying there's supposed to be 3 days of darkness October 28th. Which is a crock, of course. More Ellen and stuff.
Yeah, so just stop it, people. if you knew the science and everything that was involved that would actually make us have 3 days of darkness, that'd be pretty bad.
Impossible.
And also with this Planet X crap, listen, man, if this planet came, or whatever, came anywhere near the inner solar system, I'll tell you, it would disrupt all the asteroids in the asteroid belt, all the comets, out in the, I guess, the Oort cloud and all that stuff, and we wouldn't even see the planet because all the asteroids and comets and crap like that slamming into the planet would pretty much wipe us out.
Well, so, all the planets slamming into the planets would wipe us out.
Oh, yeah. We're only here because, those other planets keep them in check or whatever, so, yeah.
I haven't heard anything about Element anymore. Last I heard it busted up and no one's saying anything about it. Even Hoagland's not even saying much about it. He's kind of hush-hush about it. But,
Well, you find out after they make all these, ridiculous claims and sell some books and stuff like that, that it just goes away. Nobody says anything about it, and it just immediately move on to the next piece of crap on their list.
That's, I don't know what that is anymore. I can't keep up with it. But let's not get on that tangent, because we've done complete whole shows on that tangent. So let's get to our guest and see what's going down. How's it going, Glenn? Are you there?
I am. Good evening, everyone.
All right, Glenn, been reading your book. It's very, very interesting. I like it a lot. If you could, first off, Glenn, let our audience know some background about you so they'll know who you are pretty much.
Well, I guess as a teen, I was lucky enough as a young adult to work at a bookstore, an antiquarian, rare bookstore, specialized in culture, ancient culture and mythology, a fear of legend. You had mentioned your guest later this month. It's an interesting topic. So I read a lot of books as a kid, and it struck a chord. I could tell that there was a lot more that we didn't know about history and prehistory than we did know. and that series were in flux and changing, and while we were being taught something that was static for the textbooks, history is much more dynamic than that, and our grasp of it is dynamic and changing all the time. So as I got older, and currently I work as a radio frequency engineer, I had an interest in the electromagnetic spectrums, reading some of Dan Hancock's books. We had began a communication. He had asked me to write an article on electromagnetism communication for his forum. And really what prompted me to do that was reading his book Underworld and finding out about the temples on Malta. And their configuration to me was a big puzzle, just looking at how the really posed a mystery for me. So I wrote this article as part of a package of how these temples appeared to have a configuration or layout that mimics the radio frequency propagation pattern. And it was something that I thought needed to be further explored. So that article was subsequently published in the Lancet Horizon magazine, and I later became editor of Graham's website, forum, which features an author of the month every month. So I get to speak with these guys and look at their latest articles and research and books. And we publish an article once a month featuring an author who's kind of on the cutting edge of alternative science.
Hey Glenn, are you driving in a car right now?
No, I'm not. I'm sitting at home. I do have a hands-free headset on, and if you need me to speak up, just let me know.
Yeah, it sounds like you're driving and you got the window down.
No, not at all.
I didn't know that was a toilet flush, and I heard some weird noise. I don't know what that was.
That's all right. That's all right. You sound fine now.
Okay, hey, yeah, I heard that noise for a moment, too. Go ahead.
Were you talking about the civilization they dug up in Turkey? With the freestanding pylons, and it has, like, the...
Göbekli Tepe. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking of the temples on Malta. Hagar Kim. There's a few other names for them. I don't have the names off the top of my head. But there are these temples on Malta that are considered to be the oldest... or were considered to be the oldest freestanding structures on Earth. They predated the pyramids by a few thousand years. The site you're speaking of in Turkey, which Robert Schock and John Anthony West have been investigating, and actually they've been excavated for the past 10 years by the German Archaeological Institute, these ruins are really set to change everyone's view of prehistoric humans, because, of course, this site in Turkey is twice as old as the Great Pyramids. They're saying it's been, again, this is based on radiocarbon dating at the site, 10,000 BC. And then, very, very interestingly, the entire site was purposely buried about 8,000 BC. And these are, as you said, standing pillars, some of them 10 to 15 tons, with, in base relief, different animals, figures. In fact, Robert Schock did a presentation on this site at the CPAC conference that I just attended this past week in Sedona, and he talked about how these pillars are actually amorphous human figures. They have arms wrapping around them with hands, they have belts and loincloths, and then they also have animals carved in relief into their surface.
Yeah, they're thinking that it was a civilization that was kind of nomadic that would, you know, build this little temple or whatever and then bury it and move on and build another one.
Well, this site, according to Schock's research, this site was occupied for thousands of years. And it's an extensive site. It's only about 10% of it has been excavated, even though they've mapped the entire thing using subsurface ground-penetrating sonar and radar. And they've got there dozens of stone circles, most likely calendar sites, that align to events on the horizon. So it's the kind of construction that we don't expect to see from humans until about 5,000 years later in the Nile Valley, that is in between the Tigris and the Euphrates. And of course, we've known all along that the chronology of human history has some major gaps in it, and some of the research, and I discussed this in one of the articles in my book, to being done in the Western Indian Ocean, the Bay of Cambay, off the northwest coast of India. They're bringing up artifacts from the floor of the ocean, and they're mapping what appear to be ruins of cities at 40 meters deep.
So right.
This is like, last above the water before the seas rose at the end of the last ice age.
There's a couple sites off of India's coast that have, artifacts and stuff like that. I mean, I guess, a pretty nasty earthquake or a few earthquakes went through there, and, there's evidence of that,
I think the nature's park on the east side, on the southeast, and this is one of the things that scientists have to look at when they're excavating below the surface of the ocean. Has the floor shifted? Stratigraphic layers still intact, or have there been disturbances, seismic or geologic otherwise, that have corrupted the site so that we can't trust the depth at which things are found? And that's true. The floor of the sea level has changed over time based on tectonics and plate movement. But they're beginning to map this stuff, and they're beginning to isolate it so that they can determine the sites that do have valid dates. I mean, and I believe the site in the Bay of Cambay is an undisturbed site. They feel that there has not been a shift in the seafloor there, and that what they're pulling up is from before the waters rose. So there are other instances where it can be shown that there was seismic activity off the coast of Japan and China. The floor of the sea has risen and fallen substantially in the past 10 or 15,000 years, and they can determine that.
Yeah, it must have been HARP. Sorry, it's an inside joke. That's an inside joke. You're not
HARP, the thing angels play?
No, the
weather modification thing.
Yeah, that everybody's saying did the all the earthquakes we had over the last couple of years. And all the tornadoes.
What you're talking about, HARP, the high atmospheric, I don't know what the acronym stands for, but they're pulsing the atmosphere, the ionosphere, I believe, with high voltage, crazy high voltage.
Right.
There's all kinds of theories about what that's doing to the ionosphere and the atmosphere and the magnetic sphere. I've heard these concerns before, and, it makes me wonder, what the heck are they doing?
So, Glenn, you pretty much, Graham Hancock commissioned the essays for the book, and you're the editor, and you also contributed. Did this happen through your connection of working with him as the, I think you did the book, author of the month or something like that at his site?
That more came out of my writing than the writing coming out of me being the author of the month editor. He just got his hands full with some writing projects and asked if he was doing the editing of the articles. And, he gets submitted articles pretty regularly by a lot of different researchers and writers that are looking to draw attention to their theories and their books writing. So, we met a few times at the CPAC conference out on the West Coast over the past few years, and had corresponded extensively with email. And this was just something he'd asked if I would like to take on, and it's been a pleasure doing it. I get to meet these authors and talk to them and find out about their latest theories and research. So it's fascinating.
So if you could, Glenn, could you define what an alternative history theory pioneer is for our audience?
Well, I guess that would be somebody who looks at the textbooks and sees what's being taught and thinks that there are some gaps missing and goes out there and independently does some research to help fill in those gaps. and does it in a way that what they do stands up to some scrutiny. Doesn't ignore the scientific method, is based in objective research. And I think those are the kind of theory and the kind of research that gets attention, because it's hard to refute. And there's a group of alternative history researchers out there, Hancock, West, Robert Schock, Robert Hubal, there's some new guys out there, Scott Crichton, Gary Osborne, these guys have theories, Ed Nightingale, all of them pretty much studying Giza and what's been going on in the Egyptian culture going back into pre-dynastic time. The guy Thomas Gropey, who's done research in a site called Napataya in Western Sahara. This is another extremely old site, quite ancient, much older than the dynastic Egyptian civilization. And again, it's a calendar site. It's got megaliths standing up. When it was built 8,000 or 9,000 years ago, 7,000 or 8,000 years BC, it was a place that was arid, the place that, quite a nice climate compared to what it is today. And there were people there who were very much in tune with nature and with skies and with the motions of the heavens and determining how that affected life on Earth and belief systems. So Gropey is doing some important research. It's going to go a long way towards backing up the research in Turkey, which is simply showing that there was civilization on Earth twice as far back in time as currently credit. And, that itself is astounding, but if you think that perhaps we don't know that twice as long before that, there was also civilization. I mean, once you start talking about the vast amount of time in geologic history, in Earth history, in Earth science, it's not that outlandish to think of things having existed and come and gone, and there being very little evidence of it left, material evidence of it left, to discern who or what those people were. So we're really working with fragmentary evidence, trying to put a puzzle together that, quite frankly, all the pieces of that puzzle probably don't exist anymore.
Right. There are a lot of mainstream scientists that have the same issues that you do. I mean, for the in the United States, they're saying the original, inhabitants was like the Clovis people. Well, they've actually dug down much, farther in the past than the Clovis people and found different types of arrowheads. I mean, they're cut differently. It's everything's different. Fire pits, all sorts of things. And these people, they caught all sorts of hell from the mainstream, science people that were their peers, and here's they're giving them the evidence, and people just would not look at it. They were just, this is how it is.
But now they're beginning to, and a lot of the academics, a lot of the traditional researchers, in some cases, they're having to eat their words, and in some cases, they're having to kind of start to scratch their head and say, what if these alternative theories turn out to be right? So they're beginning to hedge themselves a little bit. I'm certainly vice president to NERAS, the New England Antiquities Research Association, and at our spring conference up in Portland, Maine, this past April, our keynote speaker was Danish Stanford. He's the head of Paleo-Indian Studies at the Smithsonian Institute. You don't get more mainstream or academic than Danish Stanford. He is Smithsonian's man on ancient Indian culture in the U.S.
And yeah, these guys. Go ahead. Sorry.
He's been working for many years to show that Clovis is not the oldest, and that he believes in his theory, and he's still working to prove it, not the accepted theory, is that the Neotrian culture from Europe came across below the ice sheet. He shows in his presentation how, in the past, as the ice age was ending between say 17,000 and 10,000 BC. It wasn't just one period of cold going warming, it was repeated cycles of cold and warm, cold and warm, where the ice caps descended and receded and descended and receded numerous times, a dozen times, 10,000 years. The last time the ice came as far south as Long Island and parts of Northeast America, he believed that that period, the Northwest European Solutrean culture followed the ice sheet, hunted bales in the whales that were along the ice, and just made their way to the U.S. Northeast coast, where they're discovering all along the Chesapeake Bay these sites that predate Clovis, that apparently predate the Younger Dryas period, which perhaps was started by a cometary event. In fact, it turned out it became very cold for a long time during the forming period of the end of the Ice Age. So there's a lot of evidence that's coming accumulated, and a lot of this Chesapeake Bay and East Coast evidence is coming up from offshore, from, you know, on the continental shelf. He showed a wonderful part of his presentation with this fully intact bison skull and stuff included that was dredged up by a fishing vessel off of New Jersey. And there they found in that net with that bison skull evidence arrowheads, spearheads, that humans existed when that bison was not a mammoth, but a bison. But that puts it, quite a bit further back and associates the bison with human presence, which is something that's new. That's not what's currently being taught. But it will be.
Yeah, well, scientists will pretty much only believe what they dig up. They kind of won't go outside. You know, I have this bone, so this must be, you know, this must be it. We'll change the numbers to do this. It's like they won't, they won't really expand on it, you know.
They very much are not as open-minded as other folks. They tend to work with blinders and even within the, and I think it's just the nature of researchers, because you go within your own niche. And what I found, even with my own book, The Lost Knowledge of the Ancients, and kind of surveying all these different theories and researchers, they didn't all necessarily know how their research fit into the bigger picture, fit into the elements of somebody else's research, how putting the two pieces together now, you get a clue or a hint of something that lets you bring both theories a little bit further. It's an interesting phenomenon to watch unfold.
But yeah, man, they got to publish papers, and they got to get grant money and stuff like that, and so they kind of latch on to something and try to hang their hat on it.
I think there's a great need. You hit on an interesting point, because I think there's a great need for some type of foundation, alternative history or an ancient intelligence foundation to fund the research, I don't want to call it fringe research, but the kind of research that's a little bit out of the mainstream but still is being followed up on. And I can think of a number of projects that would be worthy of foundation funding that could really provide some interesting results, whether positive or negative, put some arguments to rest if the research was done. If it was undertaken as a serious scientific study.
Right.
And I know more and more places like Stonehenge, Karnak, and these ancient sacred sites around the world are beginning to get that kind of attention. Scientists and academics and are beginning to focus their attention a little bit more on these kinds of scientific
experiments. It's like, you get comfortable with a theory. It's almost like a religion, you get comfortable, you're at peace with it and stuff like that, and you stop looking. And then when someone else comes with some new thing, and they even have proof, the old guard is kind of like, that's preposterous, there's no way, you know. And you kind of have to pull them kicking and screaming out of their comfort zone to start looking at the new data, you know, and to open up a little bit and, you know, start exploring, be a scientist, be an archaeologist, go out there and, you know, dig. You know, you always got to keep looking. And that's what I like about you guys. You know, you're always doing that. You know, it's important that you're doing that.
Well, you got to ask questions. You know, you're never going to get answers if you don't ask questions. I always say science is like a game of darts. Everything there is to know is the whole surface of the dartboard. And every theory we propose is just us throwing a dart at that board. You know, there's a lot more space that uncovers than has a dart. So, way more we don't know than we do know. So we still got to keep asking the questions and, you know, finding out if our answers are right. If they're not, probe out, come up with a new way to look for the answer.
Yeah, man. I mean, look at, like, when the glaciers came, you know, when they come down into North America and stuff like that, those things are 3-4 miles high, you know. They crushed and destroyed, you know, everything. They ground it to dust, you know. So it's kind of hard to find stuff that goes past that, or stuff that was predates, you know, the glaciers, because literally the whole landscape and all the land, and it certainly doesn't look like how it looks now. You know, the maps would have.
That's one of the issues with researching in the Northeast. It's a different environment. You know, in Northeast United States, the Native indigenous population is not credited with doing what every other culture in North and South America is credited with doing. And that's building in stone and aligning their stone construction to events on the horizon. If you look at the Athena, the Midwestern culture, if you look at the Southwest, the Hopi, the Arapaho, if you look at the Central American or Mexican cultures, the South American cultures, they all are credited with having built in stone and having have their constructions aligned with the astronomical. In the Northeast, that's not the native population is not credited with that. There are no sites of that that are recognized and identified. Now, NERA and a lot of researchers are identifying sites that they believe are just such sites, but they have not, you know, they've fallen through the cracks of archaeology and anthropology, and they're all uniformly dismissed by the academics as colonial structures. And, you know, that was a tremendous disservice to the native population that was here going back 10,000 years, and that's still here. And it's beginning to change. We're beginning to see a few sites where sites that have been threatened by development, and the native tribal preservation officers have come forward and said, wait a minute, this is a sacred ceremonial native site. And even though stonework is cairns, it's walls, standing stones that are not recognized as being artifacts and worthy of, you know, as being considered cultural resources, now the natives themselves are beginning to talk about these sites because they're becoming threats. And that's a big change. And it's forcing the Department of Agriculture and the Forest Service to start their first policy for identifying and documenting native lithic sacred sites.
You know, just living in Philadelphia, Glenn, and this area, like this tri-state area in New York, you know, people don't care about that stuff. They don't really care about history. If you go down to, like, where the Liberty Bell and everything is, I lived here for probably 8 years before I even knew how to get there. On 95, there's like one sign that says, you know, take this road to go to see the Liberty Bell. It was never, they had a lot of the old structures and they converted a lot of stuff, but Philadelphia doesn't, like, you know, raise the flag of, you know, this is where the Constitution was. It's like they don't even care.
Well, if you're saying that people don't pay enough attention to history, I agree with you. And I think it's, you know, it has tragic results in many different ways. You know, we suffer culturally as a people. There's not knowing our past, how do we know who we are today? But in very practical senses, the Liberty Bell is a monument, and people, you know, like you're saying, they don't pay much attention to it. You know, they might know what it is, but they probably don't think about it much unless it's brought up. And I think there's an interesting example from Northeast Japan. News article came across my desk after the tsunami and earthquake, saying how the Northeast Japan ignored their ancestors' warning. I thought, that's what you mean. What was that about? And I read the article, and it turns out that up and down the coast of Northeast Japan, the whole area that was devastated, there were ancient stone monuments, these megalithic monuments, built up and down the coastline, that said, you know, basically were warning. The inscriptions on them said, for a life of peace and tranquility, don't build your dwellings beyond this point, keep this warning. Of course, nobody heeded it for centuries. The last of these stones were set up 600 years ago. It was part of a network up and down the coast, a warning network, you know, telling people where to build, where not to build, that, you know, eventually, if you go past this point, devastation will happen. And of course, we know that that's what happened. So the warnings are out there. There are lessons, important lessons to be learned from history if we pay attention, if we look closely, and learn how to read, you know, read the signs, read these megaliths, read these different sites, what their meaning is. So it's important, and it's key to ignore.
Well, they think they're a bunch of, just primitive whatever, you know, it's like the curses put on the pharaoh's tombs and stuff like that. I mean, when someone from the modern age reads that stuff, they're just, they were scared of a cloud or something. You know what I mean?
And yeah, I do.
They just discount it.
That's what I find so fascinating about myths and legends how we're so quick to just dismiss them as myths and legends, and how we're not willing to look at them as perhaps messages or insightful observations by people who didn't have technical or scientific language, but couched the information and the observation in allegory and symbolism, and that's what we're handed down today. And it is really a question of cultural inheritance. How is this knowledge preserved and purposefully passed down? And, at some point, the Japanese, they found it important to put these stone markers up and to pay attention to them, but at some point they also forgot about what they were, and I'm sure people walked by them every day right up until that earthquake and tsunami hit and never noticed them. But they're probably noticing them now. They're probably considering whether or not it would be wise to go beyond them. Given that there were people who did pay attention, I saw some interviews on TV from, Japanese homeowners who say, "Oh, I knew what that was, and that's why I bought my house on this side of the line, and didn't buy over there, and I survived." So there were some who paid attention.
Well, yeah, a lot of Japanese and Oriental people that are stepped in history and stuff like that. They follow that stuff still. I mean, there's small towns scattered all over the place in Asia that have had temples. Little stone temples that people worship at that are thousands of years old, you know.
Absolutely, in India as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in a lot of those countries. You know, there's nothing like that here. There's nothing like that in Britain, France, Germany. You know, unless they're pagans or something.
I was going to say, in this country, there are the Native Americans, and that's a history that goes back 10,000 years.
But people laugh at them. People just, they're regular Americans, for the most part, think they're just a bunch of primitive kooks.
Well,
you know?
That shows Americans' ignorance, because the way the Europeans sent out so-called missionaries 500 years ago to save the so-called savages, those savages now see it as their mission to save us, save our ass. So
right.
we're the ones now threatened, and they have the real answer, not the answer that the missionaries went out with, which is a false hope or a false god, but And I know, you know, you say a bunch of pagans it's that root of human history that we've lost contact with. I mean, pagans were nature worshippers. They were more in touch and more intimate with the forces of nature than we even can conceive these days.
Look, here's my thing on humans, essentially. We are exactly the same almost as we were thousands of years ago, and I've said this on other shows, we just had better technology. You know, we still do a lot of the same things that we did back then. We do them now just differently.
Well, that's true. And you're right, human nature doesn't change, but I think it may sound funny, the nature of humans change. I think at various times, as you know, I'm a believer in history going in a cycle. And a lot of the articles in my book speak to a vast cycle in time, actually tied to the perception of the equinox. And this is documented in many ancient cultures. And it has to do with the fluctuation in the ages of man, and the rise and fall of civilization, the rise and fall of consciousness, and that is not as linear as we tend to think. And even though evolution occurs in a linear process, it has upon it superimposed a cycle of rising and falling that's tied to what I believe are forces in the universe, electromagnetic forces.
Do you think there's any correlation with electromagnetic or forces of nature with the end of the classic civilizations like Rome, stuff like that, the Dark Ages, and then like the Renaissance?
If you study the Indian Yugas, and if you study the Greek, what Plato called the Great Year, the Chinese had it as well. This is tied to the succession of the equinox, which is a 26,000-year cycle, 11,500 in one direction and then another 11,000 in the other direction. And it's supposed to be tied to a binary motion of our sun with another celestial object that interacts over this time, causing what we observe on Earth as precession. Now, for your listeners, precession of the equinox is the form of the sun appearing to back up through the constellations by 1 degree every 72 years. So it's fairly perceptible in a lifetime, but in 26,000 years, it makes 360-degree turn on the horizon through all the constellations of the zodiac, and that's what accounts for the age of the zodiac. You know, of course, now we're entering into dawning of the age of Aquarius, which in the Yuga cycle is coming out of the darkest age. And beginning to ascend again into enlightenment. The highest age, which being a golden age of man, is what correlated with the existence of Atlantis 12,000 years ago. And of course, that would mean that about 1,500 years ago, 500 AD was in the darkest part of this cycle, which of course was dark in the Middle Ages. The Renaissance came after. If you look at the ancient cultures of Egypt and Greece and Rome, they all seem to descend. They seem to be greater earlier on than as they move forward in their accomplishments and culture really descends. And that's kind of enigmatic. People don't really know why the greatest constructions of the pyramids were done at the earliest phases in dynastic history, and as you come later and later, things become much more legal. Go ahead.
One of the things that I've thought about was that, you know, we have these cycles and stuff like that, and I don't think, from what I've seen, that it's actually affecting humans. I think whatever is happening is affecting their surroundings and living standards, and then you have droughts and you have crops are dying, you got disease and stuff like that. And it's almost like the earth itself goes through this cycle, and we have this a period where we have to adapt to all the changes. I mean, they did cores in a lake, went way down, and at the time I don't know if it was the Aztecs or the Incas. I get my timeline with those mixed up, but it was the same time that they suffered a massive drought, and at the same time in Egypt and that area, they were suffering a major drought, and it kind of just put everybody back. You know, we kind of went primitive again. You know, we had to like eat berries and you know, that sort of thing. So you think maybe that it could be that these cycles within our solar system or whatever, it's affecting the planet, and we are getting our butts kicked because of it.
Well, that's not an unreasonable theory. I mean, there's no question that throughout time, human history has been affected by cataclysm. And whether it's been global in nature or just local, I mean, of course, if it happened to be local in olden times, it seemed like it was global. So you didn't know what was going on in anywhere else but your own world. So it's quite possible that as you're saying, as nature goes, so goes man's civilization. There's no question about that. And I think our clock has been reached at numerous times. But that doesn't exclude the possibility that our conscious minds may still be affected by electromagnetic forces that have been put, depending on our exposure to them. And if the theory of secession that is now prevalent, which is the Newtonian lunar solar model of secession, where the moon and the sun are tugging on the earth, the weight of the earth, the folds of the earth, causing it to, as it spins on its axis, to wobble like a top. And that's what the scientists attribute to precession, or attribute precession to the forces of gravity pulling from the moon and the sun, this wobble, making us see this spinning of the constellation around the band of the horizon over a vast period of time. And there's no question that ancient cultures took note of it. Astrology goes so far back in history, we know that they noted that the position of the sun changed relative to the constellation at the horizon. And it wasn't until Greek times that they figured this out mathematically and said that it was 26,000 year astronomical cycle. And really, if you think about it, it's no different than how the days or the seasons occur at the beginning and our relative position of the sun. And precession is just hand on the clock that is spinning much slower. But it still is the astronomical phenomenon caused by the spinning of the world.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry, just saying, and of course, the other theory that would account for us seeing precession as we observe it on Earth would be that the sun and the planet and the solar system is actually arcing through space in a binary orbit with another gravitational body, another star being a round dwarf, something may not be visible to the eye, star that we're familiar with, like Sirius or a Bernard star.
Yeah, there's something out there. Discovered it in the 90s, you know. It's just, it wouldn't be a reach at all to say that it's a brown dwarf, because I guess most systems are binary, you know.
Very true.
Are the ones that they're finding. So do you think this change, like change of the season, what effect does it have on humans to make us go back into like almost a primitive state, or to the point where we stop being innovative and we become warlike or more warlike and stuff like that? Is it something with we're being pulled or something? Is something that's physically affecting us?
There's some interesting research going on now. There's a guy named Michael Persinger in Canada and a woman from UCLA, Beverly Hunt. And they've done research with electromagnetic fields and seeing how it affects human consciousness. and basically they fill chambers that block out all EM fields from the subject, and then they tested the subject as they are basically sequestered from any of the ambient electromagnetic forces that we're all normally subject to. With a lot of them as we walk around. So the subjects in these research experiments did show marked change in their consciousness when they were blocked from the natural electromagnetic fields that we encounter, cosmic rays, background radiation, whatever we're normally exposed to. These folks had in chambers and were completely blocked from them, and they had breakdowns. They were not able to really function well. When musicians, they were not able to read and play music sufficiently. And when they're out of the chamber and they're being exposed to normal electromagnetic forces, they, accomplished musicians. But when they get in this chamber, they can't play. Same with mathematics. They're not able to calculate higher mass or equation. So if something is happening, deterioration occurs while they're in these chambers. And it is also interesting that they've done reverse experiments where they've plotted enhanced electromagnetic fields to subjects and have found that this increased perception made them, in some cases, have psychic ability or the ability to be able to respond with numbers, do things that you wouldn't normally think they'd be able to do, that they had enhanced mental capacity.
Probably messes with the magnet or the electrons in the brain, like messes with the highways and like a train track kind of switches it to go this way, and all of a sudden you can't think anymore.
Right, it's either short-circuiting it or it's not allowing the synapse to fire in the right order or something. And then when they reverse the process, they may be opening the filter, allowing the current to be engrams to form quicker, be more responsive. So there's no question that electromagnetism has an effect on our consciousness. It's just how the forces of the universe, and again, you won't get a lot of scientists that say, the Earth's magnetic sphere is really blocking out all of the radiation that comes from outside of the Earth. Even the pulses from the sun, the solar storm, and the plasma arcs that come out, those are also, we're protected by down here on the Earth by the magnetosphere of the atmosphere, which
lights
up and actually reacts very strongly to that sun, to the sun's protection. And
well,
those solar cycles as well, and what those might be doing.
I was watching a show, I think it was How the History Was, or How the Universe Was Made, or something like that. And they can actually duplicate in a lab a solar flare, like the size of a basketball, exactly like the ones that come off the sun. They collide all these materials, and they have a high-definition camera, and it's just like a half of a millisecond this happens. And when it happens, it's a flare. It's a flare of energy. And it looks exactly like what comes off the sun,
Well, you've been hearing them more and more. You've been hearing stories about them recreating in the lab these phenomena, black holes and the first moments of life. And solar flares and activities. And I'm very fascinated with what's going on with the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, Switzerland. And their search for what they call the God particle, which physicists say if they can confirm its existence, it will, of course, reshape our current theories of physics, and quantum physics, and string theory. And come to a whole new understanding of what's capable.
I think once they shrink it down a little bit and give it some more power, I think they'll be you
look at that thing, and again, you scratch your head, and you go, what the heck are they doing? It's just such a massive project, and so technical and intricate, and I'm an engineer, and I look at it, and I go, what the heck are they doing? And, you know, I'm sure when Stonehenge was being set up, or when Karnak was being set up, and the pyramids, there were people then who were looking at those structures and wondering, you know, what's the purpose of that? What are they doing that for? It's got to be something very important. Just like we know whatever they're doing in turn with the glider there, you know, it's obviously very important. It's about billions of dollars that they're looking at it for years. And, you know, they're looking for, you know, if you read about what they're looking for, they're really looking for the smallest constituents of matter.
It's the same people saying, why are we going to space? Why are we spending money on that? Why are we spending billions of dollars on this? You know, they don't get what the whole thing is. You know, it's actually finding us. And most of these people are religious and stuff like that. I mean, they've already got their little system, you know, in a box. It's all nice and tidy. You know, but there's lots of people that aren't. And this CERN actually discovers, you know, different elements and stuff like that that made everything. You know what I mean? They're reproducing this stuff, and it's really exciting stuff, man. I mean, it's I get really upset at people when they just stop thinking and lost their sense of wonder. You know what I mean?
Hey, Guy, are you in the chat room?
Yeah, we got to go to break.
Okay.
Go to break.
I'm not there, so I wanted to make sure you were at least.
Yeah, it was that one. We're going to go on a 10-minute break here, Glenn. So, yeah. And we'll reconvene, and we'll see everyone in a few minutes.
That's good.
The Church of Mavis. We're here with Glenn Feastberg, alternative history theory pioneers. I guess where I wanted to start, Glenn, I know Andrew Collins has a chapter about in the book about cosmic rays influencing human evolution. Currently, right now, I know there's been a lot of solar flares and cosmic activity, and I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are about our present time and how that fits into the cycle of human existence. It seems like we're going through some kind of transformative time with everything that's going on right now. You know, all the protests, Occupy Wall Street's grown to like a mass level that's completely just bigger than I ever thought it would be right now. And finally, the news media is talking about it on a level that's sort of fair. At first, they weren't. They were like turning their head. Obama in his presidential speech he did earlier this week, he even mentioned them and kind of sympathized with them and went into it. So everyone's paying attention to it a bit more now. But I'm curious exactly, you know, from these civilizations, their point of view and, you know, the calendar and time, what time are we living in right now? Is it a time of change? What do these ancient civilizations say about right now for us?
Well, if you go by the Indian Yugas, we're coming out of a very dark low period in human history, but beginning to ascend into a more hopeful age. But we are in a transitory period, which is very volatile. We're coming from an age of using an electric age, the discovery of electricity, the discovery of power, but in a very dirty, unbeneficial way to humankind. And a lot of the ancient cultures talked of a pure energy age, of a clean energy age, which is in some respects the next age that we will enter into. And you hear there are a lot of themes about this with technology, free energy technology, perpetual motion technology, the kind of technology that gives vision from the sun, but just technology that's going to give us a clean, permanent, unlimited source of energy for humans to function with. And we've never had that, or at least we've never had that in modern times. There may have been times in our great distant past where humans were in some way able to tap into unlimited cosmic forces, cosmic energy to focus on their endeavors. And you know, there's a lot of speculation that some of these forces were the creation of some of the great ancient monuments on Earth that today we have a hard time explaining how they did it that way without the use of modern technology. In fact, in some cases we wonder how we could even do it today using the technology that we have now. But as far as the cycle, if you break down the ages as the East Indians, as the Hindus do, into an Iron Age and a Silver Age and a Golden Age, the Iron Age being the lowest stage of mankind, lowest stage of conscious civilization, we are now out of that age and ascending towards what might be considered a Bronze Age, not quite a Silver Age, certainly not a Gold Age. But the age we've been in is very, quite frankly, shallow, materialistic, not a very deep age as far as human consciousness, and I think that's pretty well represented in our modern culture. And I think we have a very mature, sophisticated modern culture, but I think we're heading there, and it's going to take letting things unfold in nature the way they're intended to, and need to be more in touch with and more in contact with nature than that. We're blind to it now. And not many people can name the constellations, can name the stars, are cognizant of motions of the heavens. It's all taken for granted. We have applications, we have calculations that are provided for us to tell us these things, but we really don't care about it. So because as we mature a little as a society and as a people, these things will become important to us. Once you get it, they won't be constant.
So in your chapter, you contributed ancient humans had knowledge of the electromagnetic spectrum. What are some ways that it's pretty evident that they had knowledge of this? Is it pretty much just the architecture and their calendars and things of that nature?
Well, there's some other clues as well. The article, you see some of the research by an East European doctor, physicist named Smutny. He looks at ancient tapestries. He also looked at configuration for some of the mortuary temples of Egypt. And he sees circuit diagrams. He sees computer layouts and says they look very much like signal generators. If you were to create a circuit board for a signal generator, he says it correlates very closely to the layout of some temple designs on the ground of Egypt.
Yeah, it's a whole grid that covers the planet, I think,
isn't
it? Ley lines, stuff like that?
Well, that's another theory, and that's quite a fascinating theory. That theory goes that those buildings, using some of the ancient structures, purposefully were trying to manifest some good energy. And we're looking to in such a way that they tap into the natural grid that the surface of the Earth. And, you know, this is a reasonable question. It's about daylight. We know that there are these natural Earth meridians that can be mapped and they're gouging, maybe related to them. But there are these unseen energy meridians that do seem to connect these locations, separate locations. And they do seem to create an Earth grid, the energy pattern that seems to cross the globe. Now, whether it can be focused or directed by certain types of constructions or a particular configuration, both of specific energy conducting materials, the shape has something to do with it. You know, you see these hinges and all the ghosts, buildings, stone hinges, wood hinges, particular constructions. Maybe they help direct the flow of the energy, or the energy field, across the surface of the Earth, and this could account for some of the architecture, the designs of the image type. And it also may account for some of these concepts like feng shui, from the east, and also we know that there's some type of geomagnetic field that Earth is specified to navigate and migrate at a distance. So these are all questions that are tied into this type of Earth energy, magnetism, how humans use it, how animals use it. it's just endlessly fascinating. It's very close.
Yeah, they'll have, people will, there's cases of flocks of birds just flying in circles until they die because, you know, the magnetic whatever that they use to navigate, you know, is affected somehow from something and, you know, it just wigs them out. They can't follow it.
Well, it's a problem that I've heard manifested in other ways, and this is the question of this, electromagnetic pollution. There's too much of it. Are we getting so much of it artificially made that it's bleeding out the natural background that we need to be in touch with? Technology I always see as a double-edged sword. It always is subject to the laws of unintended consequences. I think we come up with something, a new product, a new technique or technology, and it seems like such a wonderful thing, but we don't always think it through. So Alvin Toffler, in his book Future Shock, years ago, really talked about how society gets affected by technology, and his conclusion was that we're just not prepared for it. We're not ready. The changes are coming too fast to have to do that. I'm not sure I agree 100%, but it is not pretty quickly to think. We have had some magic in our life.
Yeah, there's the whole communication system that, I think it was a communication system that the Navy set up. And, you know, they just sent it across the ocean, and all of a sudden the whales could talk to each other. It was messing them up and killing them, and they were beaching themselves. And, you know, it messed up the whole species of how they do things, you know.
That's pure interference. I mean, it's literally technically interference, but it's also us interfering with another creature's environment and functioning. If that was something happening to us, boy, would we take action. And, I know what you're talking about. I read about that with the very low frequency that some angels communicate. And there's an unintended consequence that nobody realized that it was affecting the whales and how they communicate. I do want to say that I read somewhere that the Navy was actually, once this was discovered, they were actually mitigating it by tuning to different frequencies other than the frequencies that the whales use. And this is one of the qualities of the electromagnetic spectrum, is it's infinite. You can always slice it and dice it into smaller and thinner bands. And we learned to utilize those bands today using digital wireless technology, but those bands were there. That electromagnetic spectrum was there. It's part of nature. It existed before we had the technology that we made to utilize the spectrum, benefit from it. But I'm not so sure, and I talk about this in my article, that humans didn't benefit from the electromagnetic spectrum in some way in the past. Perhaps telepathically, perhaps through physical means with certain types of construction. There's some fascinating articles about levitation and about using sound waves for changing the properties of solid matter. And some of the research of the Canadian, John Churchfield, who has used electromagnetic forces to change the phase of solid matter and melt metal into wood. And hermits along those lines. So I think there's an unlimited height. One of the things I say about the electromagnetic spectrum is I think of it as a medium. It's almost as if it's a medium that all of existence is recorded on. We might feel our vibrations or thoughts or our actions. Everything vibrates, resonates in that electromagnetic spectrum. And I think we stay there in some way. Echo, ghost, whatever we do, search these things, they are tied into some type of real phenomenon that mindfulness can be measured.
So, Glenn, these ancient civilizations, for instance, different ones that we know on opposite sides of the globe, are making buildings that are very similar. What is the key here? Are they much for us in the future? What I see is there, I'm trying to jump into the extraterrestrial topic, because I know you have some things like ancient Martian civilizations. You have old Hoagie in the book, Richard Hoagland, about the secret space program. And I just want to say, I do believe Richard Hoagland in his younger years and up a little bit was definitely, he hit some home runs with a lot of information. I don't think it's all, hoaxlings like everybody says, but I will say, and I believe Guy agrees with this, that with Common Element, I think he kind of jumped the shark a little bit. But I'm trying to see how, the way I look at it, it seems like these ancient civilizations are all connected to a source, which is life, or extraterrestrial, possibly in nature, and then they make these buildings to kind of commune with it. And I guess, is that the message to us, that all these ancient civilizations are connected to creators who've come from elsewhere? Is that the central message in all of their, hieroglyphics and stories and things like that?
Let me add something real quick to that.
Sure.
And wouldn't ETs or whatever also be affected by electromagnetism, just the common one of the main four common elements in the universe? Wouldn't they have the same kind of trials and tribulations or whatever that we have with that?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. Who knows what we're talking about as far as extraterrestrials, but if they're anything like us, then yeah, they would be subjected to electromagnetic forces just like we would, and they would have technology that could harness the forces of nature, of the electromagnetic spectrum the way we have created them, where they could be far more advanced. You know, it's really hard to say because it is speculative. But there is very much a, what's not speculative, what was just referred to, is that there is a common theme in most ancient cultural mythology that information was passed on or passed down from visitors. From visitors either from stars or the sky or from some far-off realm. And this is just almost a universal common theme among ancient cultures. You know, whether it's the Mayans talking about the great white world, the god who comes from over the seas, or whether it's the Sumerians speaking of the Nymphai coming from heaven, there is always an element of gods having passed on knowledge to the mortals, been the creator of mortal civilization, a mortal man. Now, whether those gods were extraterrestrials, whether they were representations of visitors from other spiritual realms, there's a lot of really interesting research about altered states and the experiences that people have when they're in them. Rick Straussman did a really interesting book called The Spirit Molecule, having to do a DMT experiment on subjects and how they all universally had experiences, not unlike shamans, where they appeared to be communicating with spirits from another world, which could easily be interpreted as extraterrestrial visitors. So when we're in an altered state, almost pause, we tend to have these experiences where we feel we've had visitation. In some cases, we take it back to the other side. And, you know, whether it's brain chemistry, whether it's a real kind of communication with an unseen world, you know, this is all open to facts and to interpretation and to experimentation. And we are beginning to scientifically look at these altered states of these perceived visitations and abductions with a new sense of maybe there's something more to it than just off the rocket. Now, personally, myself, I think that I have seen UFOs and explained things happen that I would only attribute to being a higher plane of existence, whether that's an extraterrestrial plane, whether that's an internal plane, whether that's a I'm not sure. But I think as a society, we are beginning to be incrementally prepared for something, some coming realization. I think it's really interesting. Last year, there was a press conference, National Press Club in California, where a bunch of retired Air Force colonels and majors and lieutenant general, there were about seven or eight of them, came out. He said that in the 60s and 70s, they were all in command of nuclear missiles that had UFO incidents. Do any of you guys hear of it?
I'm sorry, what?
I was wondering if you had heard of this National Press Club press conference.
Oh, yeah. See, nobody... this is what the bunkers say about that. They say, listen, airline pilots and military people or whatever, they're not any better at identifying and any of that stuff than the normal person. And, you know, I don't get any press. I don't understand why this doesn't get any press. You have these guys saying, this happened.
I was saying, why isn't Anderson Cooper interviewing these guys? You know, it didn't get any press. In fact, it was killed in the press. It was very difficult to find that press conference, that National Press Club clip, 2 days after it was on, you know, 2 days after that press conference aired live, you could find barely anything on it. Yet, to me, it was one of the most astounding things. I mean, these guys were coming out and saying that they had UFO incidences, their missile bases went down, they were not able to fire their nuclear weapons had they wanted to, but they weren't able to bring their facilities back up without having them, teams come in from outside and work on the equipment. So, and they were sworn, basically sworn to secrecy based on national security. And for 30 years, they've kept quiet. And now the time limitation has run out, and because they were allowed to speak, they did. And they simply related to the world what had happened to them. And they didn't draw conclusions, and they didn't interpret. They just said, I got a call from the security commander on the surface. He informed me there were lights hovering outside the entrance to the base, and what should I do? And the commander told him to make note of it and put the time down to enter into the log. And 5 minutes later, the same security officer calls back frantic, saying, these lights are lowering, they're coming, really in a panic. And then the base goes down. And when they reported to their commander, they said, you have to talk about this. But it's confirmed that it's happened in other bases, not just in the U.S., but in Canada and in Russia and in other places around the world.
Yeah, everywhere.
Everywhere. And not all at one time. Over a period of time, these encounters were happening where unidentified flying objects were approaching military bases, Atlas missile silos specifically, and causing them to go dysfunctional, not to be able to operate. What message was being sent, what message was received by the military during these events, we don't know, it's all blacked out, but you can imagine. Now, another thing I want to mention, I mentioned this in the introduction to my book, is Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, an astrophysicist and aeronautical engineer, aerospace engineer, Apollo astronaut, who also came out and said unequivocally that the government was covering up, a UFO incident. I believe he's referring to Roswell. Now, this is a very credible person, and I remember when he made this announcement, and it was in 2008, NASA quickly issued a statement saying that they recognized him as a true national hero, an American hero, but that they didn't agree with his opinion.
But Bill Aldrin even said, he's actually saying there's man-made things or alien things on photo, or what is it? The Mars moon?
Yeah. Hogan's claim is that there are objects he foiled for photographs that were never released. He received photographs that were never released to the public and published them. And he claims that there are clearly structures and ruins of structures visible in these photographs and points them out in his book.
There's a huge monolith on that moon, and I've seen the pictures. I've seen it on space.com, and they're like, well, what is this? And, Buzz is like, why are you asking me this question? There's a monolith on one of Mars' moons. Why isn't that in the news? Why doesn't anybody care about that? I mean,
there's so much information and disinformation out there that nobody knows what to believe and not to believe. And I heard you talking earlier on the break about the comet, the asteroid that's supposed to be passing close to Earth, depending on what you read, they're all going to be killed in a few weeks, and there's no escaping it, and the government's hiding it from it. But we know that's all a lot of bunk. Because if we critically analyze the facts that are out there, we can see that this is not the case, that it never passed between the Earth and the Moon on its orbit, either in or out of the solar system. It's of a size and mass that's inconsequential that many other things of this size have come within the same distance, and it doesn't affect us in any way. But if you're going to go out of your way to look at, when it took its nearest approach and what happened on Earth on that day as far as seismic activity, there's a lot of seismic activity on Earth every day. You're going to find something somewhere on every day that will tip the scales could tell you, oh yeah, that asteroid must have caused that Earth tremor. So, you know, looking at this stuff critically, analyzing the information that's out there critically, if you're able to do that, you can pretty much discern what's crap and what's worth paying attention to.
Yeah, listen, the scientists put these sensors like 10 feet in the ground all over the country and different parts of the world, and the Earth does not stop having earthquakes ever. It's just the plates and the tectonic plates and all that stuff, it's always moving. It's not just, it sits there and then it gets, you know, all stressed out and moves really quick. It's always moving.
And there's going to be somebody who's going to, you know, is going to correlate one of those movements with some passing by thing in the sky and say, oh, look, that's cause and effect. But, you know, it's just not the case. It's smoke and mirrors. Because, you know, like you pointed out, there's always movement. You can always find something somewhere to say was caused by whatever the latest perceived threat is.
Well, I think people just give humans, you know, too much credit for stuff. You know, I mean, nature is an unstoppable force, you know. It rules everything, and it does what it wants, you know. So I think that's where a lot of that comes from, where they think men are all powerful and we can do everything, you know. Can't cure the cold, can't feed the poor, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Well, it seems like the big resistance with all the historians that are dinosaurs and don't want to change their perspective on anything, is it because they're so against the extraterrestrial connection? Is that what it comes down to? Is that the big resistance point? Is that the main, you know? I mean, if you sit back, I've been watching Ancient Aliens. It's on the third season. There's just great thing from History Channel and everything, but is that what it is? Is that the thing that they have a problem with so badly about they just want to admit that?
You know, I think one of the problems people have with the Ancient Alien connection, one of the reactions to it is, do we really need that to explain everything that humans have done? Don't we have the wherewithal? Don't we have we've done all this stuff on our own, by our own means without having to have some outside, help, an outside force, providing us with the knowledge, providing us with, the insight to have a higher existence. I think we're capable of it on our own, with our own nature. That doesn't say that there haven't been other civilizations out there in the galaxy, and if they haven't at some point made their way to us, and what the ramifications and the nature of the ramifications are, very, very unclear, but I don't think they're necessary to explain everything that's happened on Earth. Because humans alone are enough of an equation to account for it all. They're my personal opinion.
Right.
And then
they'll just jump to like a conclusion or something like that, you know what I mean? So, you know, they kind of do that too, but, you know, those stones were sawed, you know, with, like a diamond, you know what I mean, that could cut through that.
I love the work of Christopher Dunn. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's done some amazing research on the structures in Egypt and the perfection of some of the angles and some of the surfaces. And he's shown how, we couldn't attain that kind of precision today unless we use space-age lasers and micrometers to measure that type of exact flatness, particularly the width of the king's sarcophagus in the Great Pyramid as he measured and said it's just amazingly flat and also some angles. And again, supposedly, as you said, they did this with, it was the Stone Age. You know, they didn't have metal. They were just banging one stone against another stone.
They had copper tools.
able to get these things that perfect, and it's just not like it. That's a mystery. Nobody seems to know.
Yeah, and using copper as a tool, I mean, you hit the stone 3 or 4 times, and whatever you were using is toast. It's got to be, you know, redone. It's like hitting it with saltwater taffy or something. You know what I mean?
They were using granite. A lot of those stones were granite, and that's a very hard stone. And you're not going to shape it as precisely as they did using. But if you look in a Museum of Egyptology, and you're going to see the tools that were used in that period, those tools were not used to create the pyramids, the monuments of the Giza Valley. You wouldn't be able to do it today with those tools, and you didn't do it then. There's something else used that's missing piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, I think the whole Egyptian antiquities and all that stuff, I think they're a lot like the Vatican, where it's almost like how the police will do a fake story, you know, to get criminals and stuff like that. There's a real story that's in the archives and in stuff that's hidden away somewhere, and then there's the facade that they get out to everywhere, you know what I mean? Like, how they said the pyramids were built and stuff like that, when they really know something else happened.
I think you're right. I think the evidence is probably there to disprove the current theories, and they really are working hard to keep that evidence, public as long as they possibly can. And I think it's because there is a message there, and a message that they don't themselves know yet, so they don't want a misinterpretation of it to go out there. They don't want, even if the true message is something that is beneficial or detrimental, they want to control the message. I mean, that's powers with the message and powers with controlling the message. And a lot of people think that there's a warning encoded into the layout of Giza. And, that it's prophesizing something that's very bad, pretending something very bad for humankind. And for that reason, they don't want that to come out. But I don't see that. I just think their heads are in the sand, and they don't know what it is that they truly have.
Yeah, they don't want to say we have these awesome monuments in Egypt, but Egyptians need to build them. We don't know what they are, you know?
They're more happy to give you kind of a default explanation and to stick with that and not to change that, come hell or high water. And it is frustrating. I mean, look at the age of the Sphinx. Everybody knows that it's not contemporary with the pyramids. Geology doesn't bear it out. There's consensus on that, but they never changed the textbook. Nobody bothered to make sure that the academics follow up on the evidence.
Well, yeah, they don't want, because they can't explain it. You know, they can't explain why the Sphinx's erosion is completely different than everything else there. You know, and that the head is disproportionate to the body, and if it's When they actually think about, well, when the Sphinx was built, was probably about 10,000 years ago, because that's when this place was, like a tropical forest. And it would have water erosion, and, well, look at that. The constellation Leo is rising in the morning. So we got a big lion there, you know what I mean?
It makes perfect sense. It all adds up.
It does. I mean, it really, like, right in a row. That's your data right there. And then they want to, like, shove a square into a circle and say, no.
Well, this site in Turkey, the Pepe is really going to change that. It takes time. It does take time. If you look back on this time, a few hundred years from now, there are going to be a handful of researchers You know, they're going to be seen as visionaries. They're going to be seen as the, you know, the Gene Roddenberrys, they called it. They got it right, you know. They saw the future, and they start before everybody else did. I do think within the next few hundred years, we're going to have a lot of questions headed about, I mean, there was it for the, another culture, the high civilization.
Right.
We're going to have the answers of whether there were or are currently implications from extraterrestrials. And there may be a little bit less mystery to our lives, but, you know, you solve one mystery and then another one. You know, whatever age we live in, there are always going to be mysteries to be solved by humans. That's how we can be sure.
Right. And that's what's keeping us alive, you know what I mean? That wonderment to keep moving. You know, I think when they figure out dark energy and dark matter, about how it really works and stuff like that, I think that's going to do a lot. They know things are there because other things are happening. It's like cause and effect. They just can't prove it. You know what I mean? It's like your car smashed. I know you were in an accident, but nobody saw the accident. So you can't. You know, there's nobody there to say that you were actually in an accident. But you can look at the car and see that, you know, it was trashed. That's not a crappy analogy, but.
I know what you're saying. It's you know, reality is fixed on us, and there's a guy named Todd Swanson. Are you familiar with Dr. Swanson?
Yep.
He's a physicist at MIT, and he looked at dark matter and the connection between dark matter and space and actually the occurrence of the changing of the ages and the consciousness of man. And he claims that recent discoveries in Russia by the natural physicists there, confirmed by others, that we deal with type of energy which is produced by stars that also present throughout space. So the properties are closely related to the energy that we know as chi, and also known as subtle energy. So there really is a connection in the real world and in physics with this type of power within ourselves that can lead to a fulfillment, a fuller existence that's more much with universe, more contemplative and self introspective and less material than the what we're all caught up in right now. It's very much weighed down by matter, by weight. If we get free from that, I think we'll have a greater future, but one that's kind of limited. That's what the Golden Age speaks of. I mean, people have a higher consciousness of man, but people, fear limitation, more ability to kind of soar in the heavens and just not be so focused on material.
Hey, you're breaking up, Glenn. You're breaking up, Glenn.
Oh, sorry about that. I hope you heard what I was saying.
Now, why don't you, you kind of trailed off at the end there.
So, talking about the limited nature of humans and how if we get through this age to a new age, an age where we do have unlimited power, energy, clean energy, we're not trashing our environment, there is a hopeful future. It's just we kind of have to get through the dark parts and get to that ascending time when we have more hope and more freedom to kind of soar in the heavens.
Right. Sound great now. All right, Jeff,
you guys are breaking up a little as well.
Hey, Jeff, are you still there?
Yeah, hey, I'm here. I hear breaking up, but that it. I don't know what's causing it.
Did you have some more questions for Glenn?
Yeah, Glenn, what are your thoughts on the chapter by Robert M. Schock? Did I say that right? Probably not. On parapsychology and paranormal phenomenon. And he asked the question, has conventional science missed something profound? What do you think about that essay, that chapter?
I think he built a pretty good case for paranormal phenomenon being measurable and being repeatable. I think he talks about, and I also agree with this, that there needs to be a new standard for judging certain types of phenomenon that don't hold up to the current scientific method, but are still undeniable. You know, things like dowsing, certain types of precognition. There's a lot of research that's been done. I think in his article he talks about PAIR, the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab, that looked at human consciousness and how it apparently affects random events. I think there's a lot to be said for the paranormal phenomenon movement. I do think there's scientific evidence to support that this is a real phenomenon that needs to be researched in a way that thinks outside the box. When you can show mathematically that people can predict the outcome of an event before it happens through some type of transfer of information, remote sensing, however you want to describe it, something is going on that's allowing the transfer of information at an unseen level, and what it means and how we harness it and what the implications are, that's all still to be determined. But we know now, and shocked that the proof is now there, to understand that we are experiencing these phenomena. They are documentable, whether it's, like I said, psychokinesis or precognition or being able to determine the outcome of an event of a great distance without being there. This is all phenomenon that within our realm to understand for the first time, but we need to look at it in a new way.
Have you ever heard of Greg Schwartz?
Greg Schwartz? No, I don't believe so.
He is a University of Arizona professor that did a triple blind study of people who claim to talk to the dead. He essentially proved, people like John Edward and there's some other people, essentially, they hit like 80-85% on everything. And he proved scientifically that our energy moves on after we die and keeps our same personality and all that stuff, and the world just freaking yawned. The scientific community was like, he did it completely, it was completely scientific, and people just, and the scientific community just did not give a crap because it was that far out, So when I think you get into stuff like that.
Well, it sounds very interesting, and I wrote his name down because that is the kind of thing I'm interested in finding out more about. And I believe in that. I had an experience where I felt a person passing in a dream I had, and it was very disturbing. I mean, I woke up and I realized that I had just dreamed about somebody having been killed. And then in the morning when I watched the news, I saw the event in the news of what I saw in my dream. That changed my life. I mean, the moment this person, their physical presence on Earth ended, their spirit, their energy you know, me, it's almost like it's shot out into space in every direction and passed through where I was living and sleeping and somehow affected my brainwaves. So that
did you know this person?
I didn't know this person, but I knew the place where they were killed, and it was an accident. They fell off a cliff, and I saw it clearly in a 10-second dream that I had right after I went to bed. Nobody dreams right after you go to sleep. I went to bed at midnight at 1 o'clock in the morning. I had a dream and woke up, and I said, "Whoa, that was weird seeing that person fall. You know, what was that?" And you know, went back to bed. I got up the next morning and put the news on. This is, I was living in Boston, and you know, you'd watch the news every morning because you'd want to see what the traffic was. And the lead story was about some teenager who fell off a cliff in the Quincy story. And I immediately recognized the entire event from my dreams. And it was one of those watershed moments. It just convinced me life does go on. His spirit didn't end. It's just merged or traveled someplace else when his body dies. And, you know, I almost wanted to reach out to his family. This was in 1998. but, I remember the date I had the dream. I remember, you know, it was a very short, vivid dream. But one I'll never forget and gave me a lot of confirmation in afterlife and there being more to this world than what we see. You know, as an engineer, it was a hard time accepting it and, you know, very picky. Pick and choose who you talk to this stuff about, because you share it with family members and folks that are talking about how you had a dream about seeing someone die and then watching them on the news the next day.
Yeah, they'll deny it even happened.
Yes, you know what I mean.
They'll convince themselves that
I wrote about it because I found it very cathartic to share the experience with someone. And if you Google on the web "Path of the Spirit," you'll probably come up with this because it was picked up by a paranormal site in Massachusetts that keeps track of these type of events, precognitive dreams or whatever. Anytime they have it all categorized, I don't remember the website, but it's kind of interesting. Anyhow,
it just basically tells me that there's really a lot that we don't know. We really don't know. We're still in the infant stages of. Really finding out, I think we're in the infant stages of really finding out who and what we are, and different things like that.
I would just add to that, who and what we are, in the infant stages of learning who and what we are again, because I think we learn who and what we are over and over. And
if you it's been many times.
Yeah, and if you go by those East Indian yugas and the processional cycles, and that's what it is, we are in the infancy of human existence, of human civilization. We're just coming out of it. The infancy is being the least enlightened. Then that's what we've been most recently in this cycle. But we're heading towards the other end of the cycle, which is where we're the most enlightened.
Yeah, I mean, we've been just running around like a bunch of idiots for the last, as long as we've recorded history, we've been,
And we probably will for a while. We probably will for a while longer. You can guarantee that because we are human.
Yeah.
Yeah, Glenn. Well, hey, Glenn, we're at the end of the show here. What's your website that you're at? Is it the Graham Hancock website, or do you have another website?
I do. I have a website of my own called ashnews.org, A-S-H, like Alternative Science and History, ashnews.org. And I update it as I find interesting stories on the web and interesting research projects and publications. I update the site, and there's a lot of interesting information there for people who like this type of subject. And then of course the other site is NERA, New England Antiquities Research Association. That's NERA.org, NEARA.org, and that's all about the mysterious lithic and megalithic sites in Northeast America.
Right, and you also have a book out, Lost Knowledge of the Ancients.
That's correct, with Inner Traditions, and that collection and anthology of articles on alternative science and history by some of the leading researchers and also some of the more recent and less known but cutting-edge alternative science and history researchers. look into that stuff. Check out Lost Knowledge of the Agents.
Yeah, it looks pretty interesting. Well, we got to go, man.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for doing the show, and we appreciate you coming on, and we'll be in touch. Thanks. Everybody have a good night. See you next week with a double show, double whammy weekend. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Hey, Glenn.